You're listening to a Left Lion podcast.
Welcome to another Left Lion Interviews podcast. My name is Jared Wilson and I am the editor-in-chief and co-founder of Left Lion. I'm delighted to introduce today's guest, Dave Rowntree. Dave is a quarter of the British alternative rock group Blur. He's the drummer. However, he's also been a politician, a lawyer, an animator, a composer, and quite a bit more. Dave is appearing at Metronome in Nottingham this month doing a Q&A around a book he's released of early Blur photos called No One You Know. All of these were shot in the very early days of Blur on his Olympus OM10 camera. Blur formed in 1988 and released their first album Leisure in 1991. It was a year or two after this that a teenage me discovered them for myself, and for a number of years they became my favourite band. So when we were offered this interview, I couldn't turn it down. First time I saw Blur play live was at the Heineken Beer Festival on Woollerton Park in 1993. For those who weren't around then, it was a bit like Splendour, but it was a completely free festival with no barriers or anything. It ran for a couple of years, and the two acts I remember seeing were Blur and Chumbawamba. Obviously, one of those has aged better than the other. I've also still got a VHS of the early Blur documentary Starshape somewhere at home with footage from that gig. After this, Blur made a couple of appearances at Rock City, notably in 1997, which was the same week that Beetlebum went to number one in the charts. That was in the days when the charts really mattered, and it was towards the end of my teenage years when Britpop began to become mainstream. Aside from Blur, Dave has also been a radio DJ, and in 2014 he was the regular Sunday night host on XFM. He's been a podcaster, and a series of The Dave Rowntree Show went out in 2021 and can still be found on Spotify. He's also stood as a Labour MP and was elected as a county councillor in Norwich in 2017. I didn't actually get a chance to ask him much about all that, to be honest. Instead, we spent half an hour chatting about the book, the state of the world, and space exploration.
Hi, this is Sophie from Left Lion, Nottingham's iconic culture magazine. Each month we publish a beautiful free magazine that shines a light on the art, music, food, literature and more that makes Nottingham such a vibrant and creative city to live in. It's a bit unusual for a local print magazine to exist these days, but we've managed to keep going for over 20 years, giving the city's artists, photographers and writers a platform to publish their work. We distribute 15,000 copies in over 300 venues across the county, and you can find Left Lion in every local library, every Castle Rock pub, in all active Nottingham leisure centres, and all the best bars, cafes and hangouts in Nottingham. If you're ever in town at the start of the month, you may have seen our Left Lion bike rolling around the streets. In line with our pledge to be a carbon neutral company, we deliver our magazines on foot, by electric bicycle, or where strictly necessary, by van. You can also read the full magazine and lots more for free at leftlion.co.uk. Check out the events listings on our website to find out what's going on in Notts, and if you'd like to promote your business or organisation with us, please visit leftlion.co.uk/advertise.
First off, tell me about the book. What inspired you to put it out after all these years?
What inspired me was finding the photos again. I lost them for probably 25 years and didn't find them again until shortly before lockdown, actually, and COVID and all of that. And then even then, I didn't really look through them particularly until Tim Burgess, old friend of mine, did Tim's Twitter listening parties. I don't know if you remember those.
Yeah,
everybody pressed play on Twitter on an album at the same time. Then somebody from the band would kind of narrate the album. And I was lucky enough to do three of those. And so by the third, I was kind of desperate for images of things to tweet and for memorabilia and nostalgia things. And so I thought, well, I better look through these pictures. And I was blown away, actually, by what was there. Very different to the pictures I remember taking. And, you know, we were the very, very early stages of our career, when I had a camera with me from before we were signed up until, I don't know, the first 3 or 4 years, maybe about the duration of the first album, I suppose. And at that time, nobody did know who we were. We were a tiny band playing what was then relatively unfashionable music. And Yet we were traveling down around the world, sort of living this weird jet set life, getting home without tucking the tape to rub together. So nobody else was taking, it was such a small band, nobody else was taking pictures. I'm the only one who has those pictures, really. So that's what inspired me to put it out.
And obviously, this is days well before digital cameras. So, what were they taken on? Like, what kind of a camera?
It was an Olympus OM10, which I still have, actually.
Right. Okay.
I've lost it though. That, to be fair, this is a recurring theme in these in the life of these photos. I definitely have that camera somewhere, but quite where I can't remember.
So, why is it called No One You Know? I've been looking to see if it's a song lyric or anything, but I can't trace it.
No, it's the first American tour we did. The bus driver gathered us all round the bus at the front of the tour, and he. The bus used to be an old Greyhound bus, and it had a hand cranked roller that used to have the destinations on, you see. And he'd customized this to describe the band that he had on the bus. So he had like world tour, rock stars. He took one look at us, scrolled all the way to the bottom, No One You Know. And so that was our tagline for the whole of the first American tour. And, he was a very acerbically witty guy. He meant it as a put down, but years later, looking back on it, he was exactly right. Nobody didn't know who we were. And that's what the photos capture. This band, an unknown band, just starting out in their career, just having signed a record deal and heading out on the first world tour, the first American tour, Japanese tour, heading out across Europe, first time in Mexico, when things were all brand new. Long before we started to take it all for granted, really, which we I'm ashamed to say we did a bit later, but in those days it was all wow. We were just doing things that we'd only read about other people doing, and frankly, quite often it never seemed at all likely that we were going to do.
So when you, I've read a couple of things you've said previously, and it sounds like you rediscovered all these photos in during COVID, right?
Yep.
So when you discovered them 30 years later, what did you learn about yourself and your bandmates from back then?
Well, it's odd. Two things, really. Number one, because we know each other so well and have spent so much time with each other, we're kind of like family. We're kind of like brothers, really, for better or worse. And you don't really notice your family aging, do you? So whenever I look at the band, I still see the kids in the photo, really. When I look at Damon, I still see the 20-year-old Damon. Every so often, there's this kind of glitch in the matrix, and suddenly the kind of middle-aged us pokes through. And I'm like, oh, Christ, who are these people? And luckily, the matrix heals again. But yeah, if so, that was number one, the kind of reconnecting with what we all looked like and how it felt to be us in those days. And number two was how much fun we were having. I remember it being exciting. I remember it being bloody hard work in those early days. But what comes across in the pictures is the joy we were taking in it all, and that's my kind of takeaway from the collection of pictures I've got, is just how much joy there was to be had from, that us finally getting to do what we'd always dreamed of doing.
So the photos show you visiting some quite far-flung places. You mentioned Japan. I mean, what was it like? Because you were probably like what, early mid-20s and all out there, presumably for the first time, you know?
The first time first time any of us had been to the States, Mexico, the first time any of us really had been away from home for an extended period of time. So it was interesting. It was visiting all these places, immersing ourselves in the different cultures. All of that was absolutely amazing, really good, really great, really fascinating, something I still really enjoy to this day. Equally, it allowed us the kind of perspective that travel gives you, allowed us to figure out what it was it meant to be English, what we liked about the place, what we didn't like about the place. It gave us some perspective on all of that. So that was really the birth of the next phase of Blur, really, doing all of that travel, when we just started to focus more briefly, it has to be said, on Englishness and what that all means, and as I say, what we liked about it, what we didn't like about it, the characters we knew. It was the beginning of Britpop, really, I guess.
That's really interesting. Yeah. So Graham and Alex have both also released autobiographies about their time in Blur. Have you read their books?
Yeah, I haven't pored over them and looking for spelling mistakes or anything, but yeah, flicked through them. This isn't my autobiography, by the way. Far from it. This is a collection of photos. So, yeah, they've released very different books to me, and I'm not trying to tell the story of Blur at all in this book, apart from those first few years.
I was going to say, I mean, why did you? Well, I suppose, because if you did write your own autobiography, there'd be a lot more in it than just Blur, right? And we'll hopefully come on to some of that in a bit. But, was it because they'd already done those things that you thought the photo? But I suppose it's just because you were the one taking the photos, right?
Yeah, writing an autobiography seems like, first of all, it seems like quite a lot of work. Don't really have time for it at the moment. And second, I don't think I'd write my autobiography if I still wanted to be in Blur. I'd want to tell the warts and all unvarnished story. And I don't think you can do that and still, I don't know, from my perspective, and still kind of care passionately about the being in Blur and all the music we're making and all of that. You need some sort of distance from it, really, I think, which I haven't had. There's room
So I
for it, I think.
There's
room for another voice. There's more to say, I think.
Yeah. So I'm told Miranda Sawyer worked with you on the book. Can you tell us a bit about her role?
She was the editor, so she had a... She was the motivating force behind it, really. I was struggling along with it for about a year. Well, about 6 months, probably, not making much progress because I'd never put a book together before, so I didn't really know how to do it. So Miranda's an old friend of mine, and I rung her up and said, I've got all these photos. I was starting to have a bit of a crisis of confidence, really. What if all the photos are rubbish? What if nobody's interested? All that kind of stuff. It kind of keeps you awake at 4 in the morning. So I sent her a selection of the photos and she bit my arm off, really, and was keen to be involved. So, yeah, she was like the motivating force. She's written a number of books. She knew how to do it. She showed me the ropes. She helped me come up with techniques for things. Like, quite the bit I thought was going to be easy turned out to be the difficult part, the selecting the photos from all the hundreds I'd taken and then putting them in some kind of order that told a story. I thought I could do that in a couple of afternoons, juggling them around a bit. You know, it would somehow emerge quite naturally. I don't know why I thought that, but didn't happen like that at all. That was a very difficult and involved process. So she was invaluable there, and yeah, she gave me feedback on the written parts. She helped a lot with the captions. She kind of started the captions, and I finished them. And she did a lot of need more words here kind of editorial things, so that was useful. And can you give an example of what you've just been talking about kind of things? So yeah, she was great.
Well, she's a perfect person to have on board, right? Seminal
yeah.
journalist, and particularly of the kind of the Britpop 90s kind of era. So the first time I saw Blur, I was 14 years old, and you played a gig at the Heineken Beer Festival in Nottingham. We'd heard your music before. We'd got Leisure, and I think Modern Life is Rubbish had just come out. And then we were like, what, that band's playing? It was a free gig as well. It was a free gig with no, like, barriers or anything. And this, honestly, seminal moment in 14-year-old my life. Do you remember anything about that gig?
Not that specific gig, but we played Nottingham a lot. It was one of those early places that kind of took us to their hearts, really. Yeah, where we could be guaranteed a good audience and guaranteed to have a good show. So yeah, there were a few places, mostly outside London, to be honest, in Birmingham, Nottingham, Newcastle to some extent, you know, that were kind of early adopters of Blur. So yeah, we ended up with quite a lot of friends in those areas, and especially Birmingham. All of our crew really working with us to this day are from Birmingham, because it was the first place really where we could play large audiences and needed a crew. So we grabbed all these people and took them with us.
Well, it's funny looking back at that gig as well, because it's in your Starshape documentary, which I've got. I mean, I've got somewhere on a VHS at home, but I've watched a bit of it on YouTube as well, and it's amazing to see, you know, because obviously Blur's become this such a big band, but at that time, you know, it brings back a lot of memories of, you know, of being, I guess, an early adopter. Another time, so you mentioned you played a few times in Nottingham, from what I know, and you played at Rock City a few times. And the second time at Rock City, I think, was in 97, which was like Beetlebum had just gone to number one, basically. It was like a day after it, and everybody, I mean, that gig sold out very quickly. And it was this time where you were like, you know, shit, they've gone to number one. Like, that was, you know, when that meant something, really, when alternative bands weren't really doing that. Any memories of that time?
Yeah, I mean, there was a the kind of mainstream of music changed pretty quickly. As you say, there was for most of our early career, people's focus was on something else. First, there was Manchester, and then Nirvana released Nevermind, and everybody was talking about American music. And it was very frustrating for us, as so we thought we were brilliant, and yet all these other bands were on the front pages of all the papers. But the mainstream switched very quickly. The American thing ran out of steam. Most of the bands following in Nirvana's wake weren't anywhere near as good. And people were looking around for something else. And there was us, and there was Oasis, and a few other bands doing something quite different. And suddenly the mainstream switched almost overnight, it seemed to me, to adopt all these new bands. And we were the ones that started getting in the charts. We were the ones that, you know, where we'd been to nightclubs and there'd be paparazzi waiting outside, shooing us out of the way so they could take the pictures of the people that they wanted to take pictures of. Suddenly they were there waiting for us, you know, screaming obscenities at us as they used to do to try and get a reaction. So all that was just incredibly exciting. But yeah, it seemed to me it happened kind of overnight, really. Suddenly the structure of the audience changed, much more young girls, far fewer indie anorak blokes. That didn't last very long, but nearly drove Graham mad in the process. But yeah, it was all of that time was a time of incredible change, very exciting, felt very gratifying. We've been struggling for a long time, and to suddenly get that recognition was really nice.
The last little question about Rock City is, Rock City, where I come from, is quite a unique venue. It's going to turn 50 years old in a few years' time, basically. And it's one of the original, I guess, what they called toilet circuit back in the day, right? Where it's not become an O2, it's not sponsored by a phone company or anything like that. It's very stands alone in that, really. It's particularly with the lead mill, you know, with all the things that's happened to the lead mill. Do you have any memories from Rock City to share with us?
I don't have any anecdotes, but yeah, it was part of the circuit in those days. Yeah, it was all rather disparagingly called Toilet Tour, wasn't it? I remember that now that you've mentioned it. I'm not sure if actually Rock City was included in that, because I think it was actually quite nice. It was the dressing rooms that people were saying were toilets, not the venues. Because the dressing rooms in the kind of small to medium clubs everywhere were just utterly disgusting. They've been kind of wrecked by every band who'd ever played there, and as a result they were just awful places to be, you know, especially if you're trying to get the vibe in order to go on stage and play in front of a few hundred people. It's like, oh my god. But yeah, that was the bread and butter, really, for bands like us in the early days. And we would do this circuit with a few London dates, and then head off around the cities, around the country. And yeah, we played, God knows how many times we played Rock City, a number of, a number of them, and the kind of equivalent clubs in all the other towns as well. But yeah, in terms of anecdotes, it was a bloody long time ago. You'll have to forgive me. It's hard enough to remember what's going on in those pictures, let alone what happened at a particular gig 35 years ago.
Right, fair play. Right, I want to ask you about a few other things as well. Beagle 2 space mission, right? So, from what I'm aware, there's a spacecraft somewhere on the surface of Mars. Is this
There
correct? And it's
is,
got
yeah.
a nine note melody, like a call sign that you guys wrote. Is that correct?
Yep. So the late Colin Pillinger, who was the head of planetary science at the Open University, had got a won a competition. The European Space Agency had put out a competition to academics to design an experiment to go on a Mars orbiter called Mars Express. And Colin, who's a very well-known academic, he was the pioneer at analyzing the moon rocks sent back by NASA. That was his claim to fame. When the moon rocks came back to Earth, they got sent to Colin. He developed all the techniques for analyzing these rocks and thus discovering the provenance of the moon in the result, as a result, really. So he wasn't some kind of backwater kind of nobody. He's very, very well respected in the space science field. He had won this competition to put a science package on Mars Express, which had 25 kilos of mass left over, and enough space to put one more experiment on. Lots of people had submitted, kind of magnetometers and boring stuff like that. But Colin had designed in 25 kilos an entire lander and experiment surface experimental package, but he couldn't find anyone to fund it. So Alex and I from the band came across him. We were both interested in space, and we were looking for a project to support, really. After a number of phone calls and a number of meetings, we got pointed at Colin, and he took us under his wing, and we became his head of PR for a while. We talked his mission up. So we were promoting an album at the time, and when the journalists would say, "Why did you call your album whatever the hell the album was called?" we would say, "We don't want to talk about that. We want to talk about Colin Pillinger. He's got a spacecraft, and he can't get any money. Blah blah blah." So in the end, he got match funding. Who the government agreed to part to match fund every pound he would raise with another pound. So he only had to raise, I don't know how much it was. It was about 10 million pounds. So he raised 5 million. The government gave him the other 5 million, and he built his spaceship. He was very, very good at coming up with fun PR ideas. Like, we were big friends with Damien Hirst at the time, so he needed a card to when the camera unfurled, it needed to point at something of a known color in order to I can't even think of the word now, but make sure that the colors the camera was seeing were kind of the correct colors. And so Damien Hirst did this spot painting. He was famous as
Test card, is that what it's called?
something like that, a calibration card. That's right, a calibration card to calibrate the cameras. So Damien Hirst did one of his famous spot paintings, but in all of these minerals that you have to calibrate space-going cameras with. And so that got a lot of press. And for us, he said, "Well, if when the lander lands and it has to send back a signal to Earth saying he's landed and everything's working, why don't you write that signal? Write a piece of music, and then that could be the signal." How many notes do we have? Nine. Oh, okay. So we wrote this nine-note piece of music, which we went on to expand on and record, and was a B-side on one of our singles. Can't remember which one. So a million things all had to go right for this thing to land on Mars. No country has ever landed its craft on Mars at the first attempt, not even NASA. In fact, NASA didn't even get anywhere close on its first attempt. They mistook pounds for I don't know, they mistook imperial measures for SI units and shot off into space in the wrong direction. But we did 999,999 of the million things did go right. the lander got attached to Mars Express. Mars Express made it to Mars. The lander detached and headed down towards Mars. And everything else had to go right. The parachutes had to deploy, the airbags. All of this was actually untested technology that's in standard use now. And we were the first to have airbags rather than retro rockets. So the lander would touch down much faster than you would normally allow, but it would simply bounce and roll until it came to a stop, rather than having expensive and heavy retro rockets. So the lander did indeed hit the surface of Mars, rolled to a stop, the airbags detached. And then what didn't happen, there were five solar panels that unfurled. It was a circular lander like that, and the solar panels were all piled on one on top of the other. All five had to deploy, and then the radio package was underneath that. Four of those five deployed, the fifth one didn't. So the radio, unfortunately, was shielded, and it was unable to contact Earth. What we knew at the time was that it headed off towards Mars, and that was the last anyone heard of it. But NASA did it's called Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, the spaceship that took very ultra high resolution pictures of the Martian surface to look for future places to land, down to 2 meters. And the spaceship was about 2 meters across, so they eventually found it. And they found the airbags and the parachute and all of that, and they could see this kind of clover leaf shaped thing, which meant that four of the solar panels are deployed, but not the final one. So all missions now have a external aerial. That was where we went wrong. We relied on all five of the solar panels deploying. So all missions now have an external aerial, so that if the solar panels don't deploy, you still have some hope of contacting it and maybe rocking it about a bit. We always knew that was going to be a problem. And Mars, the surface of Mars, is a rocky, dusty surface. We knew if it had to stay relatively upright, and a rock bigger than kind of that could mean that it would be tipped over too far, and the solar panels couldn't deploy. So we never got to hear our nine note thing played back. That was absolutely brilliant to be associated with the project. It's something that the UK should have been incredibly proud of. And Colin, as a result, Colin got blamed for the failure, which is a joke, because nobody knew what had gone wrong. And the space authorities just made some assumptions about the parachute not working or something, none of which turned out to be true, and said that Colin had mismanaged the project, which he hadn't. It was simply bad luck. And as I say, nobody else, no other country other than the UK has ever even got to Mars in the first attempt. We're the only people that have ever done that. So it's something, in terms of engineering and achievements, it's something we should be incredibly proud of.
It's amazing to think that's out there. So,
yeah,
still.
It is.
Is there any way to listen to that signal? I mean, maybe not direct from Mars, but have you got recordings somewhere of that?
Well, as I say, we worked it up into a track. So it's called Beagle 2. It was on the B side of one of our
right.
singles.
Yes, search that out. I'm
yeah.
going to search it out. So you've done a lot of things outside of Blur as well. Another thing I've noted that you worked on the score for the brilliant 2018 documentary Bros After the Screaming Stops. I mean, I had no idea until this week you were involved in that, but I remember that documentary and it was amazing. Tell us about that experience.
Well, that's my day job, really, film scores. That's why I'm in the studio now writing, finishing off the score for The Capture, which is the BBC show about to be out next 2 weeks' time, I think. Anyway, start of March. That's next week, isn't it? The start of March. And I've got another two TV shows on the go, one for Amazon and one, I think, for Channel 5. And yeah, that's my day job, really. That's what I do when I'm not doing anything else. Bros, I did because I knew the director. I'd done some favours for him, actually. I did one score overnight when the disaster happened. He needed an emergency score. He rang me at 6 o'clock in the afternoon and said, I need this by 9 o'clock tomorrow morning. So I did that. So he got he the Brost film got kind of dumped in his lap, really. Somebody else had started it but couldn't finish it. And he rang me and said, I've got this project. I'm not going to tell you what it is because you're going to say no. You've just got to come to the edit and have a look. And then if you want to say no, fine, but I guarantee you won't. So I said, all right then. So I turned up, and lo and behold, it was Bross. And he just started his edit. And so he'd put aside a bunch of the craziest things he'd come across from the film, the kind of funniest bits and the kind of most moving bits. And he played it to me, and I was immediately hooked. So I started work on that there and then. So yeah, that was great fun. That was the beginning of my composing career, really. I'd done a bunch of small jobs before that, but that kind of propelled me up to the sort of professional status of composers. So I started getting serious jobs after that.
Amazing. You're also quite active politically. You've been a county councillor in Norwich and you've stood as a Labour MP a couple of times. How do you feel about the country at the moment under Keir Starmer and
Well, it's not going as I expected. The Starmer government. Let's leave that there. But the country in general, I think, is the world is getting increasingly dangerous. I'm getting increasingly anxious that Western countries don't seem to be taking the threat from Russia and the threats from China particularly seriously. Seems to me we should be rearming at a much faster rate than we are, not in this kind of aspirational, yes, I want to be spending 0.5% extra by 2050. I think we need to be rearming now. That's my view. And what can I say? The world is an increasingly dangerous place, increasingly polarized place, a downside to the increasing connectedness of the world seems to be the increasing polarization of it. It's a trend that started, I think, with the printing press and has continued. And the more connected we get, the more polarization there is. I don't know how what the antidote to that is, but we better find one fairly soon because this connectedness thing is only increasing. It's not beyond the realms of possibility. In our lifetimes, we're going to be telepathic. I mean, that's what the direction of travel for research is, us being able to kind of communicate without holding a phone in our hands. So what's that going to do if we're connected to that extent? And if connectedness breeds divisiveness, what on earth is that going to do to civilization? But yes, there's the we've got to take the we've got to take people like Putin seriously when he says he wants to destroy the West. We've got to assume he actually wants to destroy the West. So we really need to learn the lessons of our slowness to rearm in previous wars.
And obviously, closer to home, we're seeing like the rise of reform and things like that, and other parties beginning with re, which is, like you're saying, increasing that polarization, right?
Yeah, we'll see. If this is midterm, things always look bad. Midterm, kind of fringe parties tend to do well. Remains to be seen if reform actually get the spotlight on them and are held to account, whether they remain a serious political force. Certainly the councils they've taken over are doing spectacularly badly, so that's not going to give people much confidence in them, I think. But we shall see. I think what's certainly true is the two-party system is dead. So, what will replace it? That's the question.
So going back to the event in Nottingham, tell us what can people expect when they come to Metronome? And do you know that Dean? I know Dean who's doing the interview. He's a great local kind of pioneer of local music, really.
Yes, I'm not sure I've ever met him, but I know of him. But yeah, it's going to be he and I in conversation. I'm going to be telling the story of the early days of the band, really, and using some of the photos to illustrate it, and talk about what it felt like, what happened. I'm going to talk about who I was then and how things have changed. It's going to be funny. It's going to be interesting. and it's going to be a little indiscreet.
We know it's hard having to wait a whole month in between Left Line magazines. Heck, it's difficult enough getting through the week. Worry not, listener, we've answered the call. You can get a pithy, up-to-date digest of the best stuff going on in Nottingham each week direct to your inbox every Wednesday by signing up to the Left Line Weekly newsletter. Left Line Weekly contains our top recommendations of events, new content, exclusive competitions and more besides. So what are you waiting for? Visit leftline.co.uk/newsletter to sign up now.
There we are. Dave Rowntree, everyone. So, Dave is appearing at Metronome Nottingham on Friday the 10th of April as part of his No One You Know book tour. He'll be in conversation at that event with our friend Dean Jackson from BBC Nottingham's The Beat. I've got a copy of the book myself and it's good fun, particularly if you have memories from that era. Copies will be on sale at the event too, and if you ask really nicely, I'm sure Dave might even sign a copy for you. I think it's been almost 30 years since Blur played a gig in Nottingham, and they're the kind of size of stadium band now that they might never do again. However, I realised after I'd spoken to Dave that three quarters of the band were playing in Nottingham in less than a month. So the bass player Alex James brought his Britpop classical concert to the Theatre Royal and Concert Hall on the 17th of March. Following that, Damon Albarn's Gorillaz had a gig at Nottingham Arena on Saturday the 28th of March. I know this because I was looking through the listings on Left Line's new events only website, Notts.com. If you haven't looked at Notts.com yet, I definitely recommend checking it out. As our regular listeners will note, this is our first Left Line Interviews podcast since the one I did with Hetain Patel last October. Become a bit of a side project for us recently as we're busy with the magazine and various other things. However, the good news is that I can confirm a mini revival and I have two more in the bag for you coming out of the next month or so. The next one is with Notts County goalkeeper James Belshaw. He's Notts born and bred and he's fast becoming a bit of a personal hero for me as a lifelong Magpies fan. As well as that, I chatted to Jim Barron from Crazy P, White Elephant and various other musical acts a while back, and we've tidied that up nicely into an audio piece for your audio entertainment suit, too. Thanks to you, our listeners, for staying right till the end. Bye-bye!